Hi, I'm Trish England, sitting here outside of Atlanta. Welcome you to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on the Internet Archive, archive.com, and on a number of podcast platforms. If you missed any of our previous shows, they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify podcasts, now reaching millions of fans. Download the app and listen on your phone, your car radio, or your computer. So, audience members, kindly mute your phones. Thank you. Tonight we call this show GTP in 2023. We'll look at the history of the class, how it diverged, recoalesced, and evolved into DPI, and now it's about to become GTP again. We sentimentalists just love that. Our guests will help us to relive the past and look into the future with two veteran crew chiefs of former GTP teams, Gary Cummings and Michael Colucci. And for insight into the recent past and the very near future, we want to hear it from two top factory Acura teams. We have Michael Shank, winner of this year's DPI Championship, and Travis Hogue, crew chief for Wayne Taylor Racing, also on the big podium in points. Gentlemen, I am so proud to have you with us tonight. This is a special occasion for me and our audience. There's a huge excitement about the 2023 season, and the renaming of the top series brings it back to where it belongs. Yay! First off, I'd like for the guys to tell us in 50 words or less, just kidding, who they are, their earliest and then finest moments in racing, and how they got where they are today. And who would like to start that?
No, I'll let Travis go.
Oh, okay. Come on now.
Jump off in the deep end, man. if we give it to Gary, he'll never know. He'll never get a chance.
Well, Gary's got the most history, so he should be the one that starts this.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't.
Well,
yeah.
He should be an inspiration.
You're the youngest. We have to review our notes.
Okay.
Well, if somebody doesn't start it, I will.
So I'm Travis Hogue. I started with Chip Ganassi Racing back in the early 2000s. Got involved with Wayne Taylor Racing in 2006 and been here ever since. I think some of the highlights are watching the development of the cars over the years from the Rileys back in the 2004 era up to what we have now, seeing the technology and stuff develop. And then when we went to the first Corvette, winning five races in 2017 in a row, was a pretty good highlight for us.
Slow down. Okay, I hear you.
This is Mike Shank from Meyer Shank Racing, and I've been around for a long time, a while. I started in sports cars. I started in 2004 in Daytona Prototype, and had decent success all the way up to 2012, and we won our first Rolex 24, which was probably our first huge moment, big moment for our team. And then we kept building the program, and eventually we got factory MSX VPD program, won the championship 2 years in a row there. I then did an IndyCar program and won the Indy 500 there, and then switched back to Daytona Prototype DPI, and have done it for 2 years, and we were lucky enough to win the championship this year. So a lot of water under that bridge.
It was amazing to watch.
What a fantastic story.
Yeah.
Michael, you want to go ahead, Colucci?
Okay. Michael Colucci. I started working for Brumos Porsche, Brumos Porsche Racing, 1973 through 1980, when Peter died. Along those years, we were IMSA driving champion 73 74 75 78 79. And Peter died, I went to work for Interscope Racing, and after that Preston Henn, won Daytona and Sebring in the same year in 1985, and then went to work for Jim Busby. We're racing 2962s from 85 to 90. Then I started my own business, 92, and we ran all kinds of cars, and Lola T600, that was in the early 80s. And then from 2003 until 2000, through 2010, I did the Daytona prototype thing for Brumos. And I guess the highlight would be I was lucky enough to be on the winning team in the Daytona 24-hour race 8 times.
8 times. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty lucky being with the right group of people.
Well, it's not like you didn't influence them somewhat. Of course you did.
Well, I'm good teachers.
All right. My name is Gary Cummings. I was started in SCCA in 76, and my first worked as a mechanic actually with Alex Job on a 914-6 at 1976-77. We didn't realize that until about 30 years later. Started with a 935 with Preston Hinn. In 79, we'd run a Ferrari Daytona and offshore powerboats. And when Preston decided to go, racing, I was his first full-time, mechanic and, left Preston, went to work for Gerritsen. This is kind of what's special about the whole GTP thing. I was lucky enough to work when we introduced the first Lola with Brian Redman in 81, and then with Bobby Rahal with the March 82G in 82. And then going back to Preston, and actually Michael and I worked together at the end of 83 and 84 with Preston, was the only American that had a 956 Porsche. And we prepped the car, the two of us prepped the car, and finished second at Le Mans in 84.
Wow.
And also received Preston's 962, which was, I believe, the fourth car that was made at that point. Wound up wanting to be a full-time racer and moved to England in 85 to work for John Fitzpatrick. But my goal was to end up at Bruin Motorsport and run the Jägermeister car. And I wound up being able to do that in 86. We actually won the world championship at that point with our 962s and ran in 4 different championships and did 27 races a year around the world with that. And did some other odds and ends, Paris Dakar, Kia's team manager, and some other oddball stuff, and wound up coming back to the States after 20 years and became the Rolex Series manager for Grand Am, and then was the IMSA Series manager during the merger. What I think was just fantastic about this whole thing is really, and Michael certainly knows this. Michael Shank certainly knows this from being involved in running DP cars, Gen 1s, Gen 2s, Gen 3s. But watching Jim France's vision, we knew from a long, long time ago this is where he wanted to get. And having the OEM corporate support now and everybody that's buying into this new car is just fantastic, and I'm just thrilled to look forward to going into this this new season with these cars.
That's wonderful. All of you are so accomplished and have, you know, such a portfolio. It's mind blowing. So we've got some good guys on tonight. Now we go to the old guys. What made GTP so special in the IMSA? And was it just the cars, or was it also the teams and drivers, or what made it? It was its own culture.
You said DP or DPI? DP or DPI?
GTP. We're starting with the past.
Oh, okay. Do you wonder what made the GTP car so special? Because most of us that raced the GTP in the early days had evolved from racing sports cars, and mostly, you know, we were involved with the Porsche 911 based car, the RSR, and then 934 and 934 and a half, and then the 935. So the cars really up to that point, aerodynamics was kind of a small percentage of the performance of the car. Then all of a sudden, the ground effects cars with the tunnel, and it was a Lola T600 was the first one, and that was a huge step forward. So it was a real learning experience. But, you know, the biggest thing, though, about the GTP cars in particular, the Porsche, which exceeded the Lola T600, I mean, the rules were so loose with IMSA. As long as the thing had a Porsche engine in it, you could do whatever you wanted with the car. You could change the bodywork. You could change the suspension. You could change the engine management system. And you could do just about anything you wanted. Whereas the prescription racing like today, which I call it, where everything is regulated, and basically the crew guys are just changing parts, and you have to buy all the stuff from a manufacturer. So it was pretty interesting because you got to have a lot more freedom and a lot more expression of what you could do with the car that modify the performance. And, you know, if you ever go back and look at some of the vintage Porsche 962s that people race, there's no two cars are the same. They look different.
Right.
They all perform differently. So it was a big step forward for all of us that had been in racing for a while, you know, making a big change from GT cars.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it was there was such a discovery period for all of us, and I think one of the things that a lot of us, and Michael and I have talked about this, and Shapiro and I have talked about this, watching Formula One struggle with the new ground effect this season and porpoising and all the rest of it, and we're going, dude, we had that problem in 1981. You know, the underbody flexing, you know, it's too thin. You've got to, you know, stiffen it up. It's loading and unloading. And being able to play off that. And when we first started, we didn't have radial tires. You know, you had to have the sidewall was so thick that you could have a flat tire and you couldn't physically see that the car was down. I mean, how many times, Kaluch, did you hear, you know, I've got a front. You know, the front's flat. Well, we knew after a while it wasn't the front was flat, the left rear was flat, you know, and you would come in. But I think there was a discovery period there, Trish, that the groups that were building this were so small. The March cars was just a small group of people that were involved with it. Eric Broadley would come to all the races that – you know, when we were running with Lola, and it was just John Bright and Eric Broadley, you know, that was doing these things. The size of the teams were minuscule. You know, we didn't have adjustable shocks in the beginning. We didn't have a lot of these things. But as Michael said, we could basically do whatever we wanted to do. You want to put a front wing on the nose? All right, let's put a front wing. You want to move the rear wing forward 8 inches and drop it down at certain tracks and stick it up in the air at other tracks? Yeah, let's do that. You know, you want to hand cut qualifying tires for intermediates? Sure. You know, let's do that. You're in the truck doing that kind of stuff. And it really made it a lot more fun for those of us that were doing it because it really did open up. It allowed you to be innovative. And you didn't rely on the factory. As we went up and started racing in other races or when, you know, against these factories, I mean, that was the goal. You had to out-factory the factory, whether that meant that you brought better drivers or you had an Andile engine instead of receiving the engine from Porsche, or you had different chips, or you used Garrett turbos instead of KKKs, or you made the exhaust out of Inconel so it didn't crack after 24 hours like the stainless did. You know, all of those kind of things, it was really wide open. But yet the budgets that we were able to do stuff with, you know, were tiny. Even in the dollars from 40 years ago, they were tiny compared to what they are now, because you had three or four guys that were full-time guys in the team, not 15.
How did you get along without all the electronics?
Great.
Very well.
Very well. Yeah, I think so too. Just one or two fewer things to break down. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say one, just to, you know, one really quick story. We won Spa in 86 with Terry Boots and Frank Jelinski, and in the Jägermeister car. And after the race, Peter Falk, who was the team manager for the Rothmans team, came over, and we were pushing the car to tech. And only the English teams had a limited slip diff. All the Germans ran spools. So that right there tells you the quality of guy that you had to have that was confident enough to pitch a 962 around or go down through Eau Rouge with no limited slip. And so we kept saying to him, no, you don't need to help push the car. We got it. We got it. No, no, I'll help you push. And we come to a corner, and to disguise the fact that the tires weren't chirping because they were trying to turn at the same speed, we scuffed our feet. And he looked down and he saw that. And he looks at me and he goes, ah, okay, now I know. And that was one of those things that we were able to out-Porsche by coming up with an English limited slip and sticking it in the gearbox. I mean, it'd be unheard of these days. You'd be disqualified for 100 years. Anyway.
I love that. Well, speaking of, you know, going to Europe and picking up all kinds of stuff, WEC changed a lot, of course, when it came into IMSA. And how was that? Those cars were back early in the early 90s, were swoopy like a prototype. How did they influence the DPI class that came up later? Or is that a not logical assumption?
I don't know who you want to answer that.
I'm not sure anybody should.
Are you talking about old GTP to new GTP?
There was, you know, there was a lot of evolution in between the two, with WEC in the middle.
Well,
yeah,
I think what the, Michael, let me bring up, you know, everybody complains about the Proto Turtles. You know, when Grand Am came in after the and came up with the Gen 1 and the greenhouse, the cockpit was so wide, and that was basically an overreaction to the accident. I believe that was at Homestead. Isn't that correct, Michael? Shank?
That was before my time there. Are you talking about the guy that got hurt that killed in the car?
Yeah, the guy that had the open cockpit and had the massive head trauma accident, and that kind of brought us back to, on the Grand Am side, back to putting a roof on the car and getting away from the WSC cars that we were running in 93, 94, 95, and I think it was Scott Sharp's accident on the LMS side at Road Atlanta. If you remember, he crashed and flipped And before the car rolled over, when it was totally inverted, you could actually see his head was sticking down further than the roll cage, than the roll bar in the back. And so I think that's what led us to going back to having roofs over our heads, which kind of led us back into where we were before. You know, there was a period of 4 or 5 years with open cars, but I think at the end of the day, and you can certainly see this with the halo and all of that that's coming into formula cars, and I think WC and ACO is even making the halo mandatory in their WC cars now. But I think that's what kind of led to getting us back on track to where we are today. And I think, and Michael or Travis, you guys can confirm that, I think that the push to get towards the hybrid actually came from the manufacturers. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They want to make the current cars relevant to what we're doing on the street today, and they're all going electric. So at the minimum, we had to go hybrid. And I will say one thing, in my opinion, and Mr. Colucci can probably back me up on this. The DP thing for me, the DP in 2004 saved my business. And what do I mean by that? Yeah, maybe the car wasn't pretty, but in some people's eyes, but the competition was intense, especially. From a 4 to 10, I would say, to 2010. And this is why. Teams like mine, who were young, emerging, didn't have a lot of money or assets or resource, because the rules were so tight, relatively, it allowed teams like us with a decent engineer and good driver to do well and to place well and finish well.
Absolutely. I agree with Michael. 100%. The racing is so much better now than it was in the old days. I mean, well, a couple times we won the 24-hour race by 24, 25 laps. You know, the race was over when it was still an hour to go. Now, the racing these days, I think, was a step in the right direction, even though it wasn't quite so interesting for the guys in the crew. But the racing's taken an enormous step forward.
And when I'm speaking, way more entertaining for people. And what I've said to many people is that my team as a business, as a functioning small business, wouldn't be where it is today without Daytona Prototype, because of our ability to win races. If my team tried to come in when the Bud Light Jags are running and all that stuff, we would be a little mark in the history notes somewhere, right?
Well, there would definitely be fewer cars capable of winning races, that's for sure, in the old days. You showed up at a 24-hour race with a 962. There was maybe 4 or 5 cars capable of winning. That was it.
Yeah, I can remember Rolex races where we had 16 cars within a second in qualifying. And out of that, you had 3 or 4 different makes, and you had 4 or 5 different engines on that. I mean, that was not a fluke. I mean, that was by design. And to back up what Micah was saying, and again, I was an official at that point, and actually seeing, you know, how we were steering these things. I just think of the engine budgets. I believe, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong there, I think wasn't the engine program was like less than $300,000 for the year? For the lease program, you know, back in like 2008, 2009.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what it was for Porsche. We figured out it was about $2,200 an hour.
Yeah. But, I mean, $300,000 to do 15 races, 14 races a year is nothing. And to go back to the time period and you know, you look at the 91, let's say, with WEC, where they had 3.5 liter Formula One engines in it, you had a trailer with 4 engines in it, you know, and you popped them and you stuck another one in and you blew that one up and you stuck it in. And every friggin' motor was $250,000. So, I mean, that was
a formula that was nobody could keep that up, you know. I mean, my concern, having been on the end of it at that point and really hoping that, you know, a team could run a prototype for less than $3 million a year, you know, and do Daytona and do Watkins Glen at that point. We didn't have Sebring and Petite, obviously, but, you know, I mean, that was a real program. And you had guys that were, you know, coming in and just fantastic guys. John Pugh and was a tremendous asset to the series and just had a blast, you know, could go out and compete. You didn't have driver ratings. You didn't have all these other things, but we took into account to try to be able to, you know, have a non-professional driver get into a program where he could compete against other teams for the overall win, and it worked.
I think that Michael's point about the DPIs or the DPs being instrumental in being a viable business opportunity, it hits the nail on the head. In the old days, you know, we were rich guys. We were just kind of a pastime for us, you know. Wasn't really a business.
No, we're not a business.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, Trish, go ahead.
Where are we now? Where are we now?
Well,
how much work has it taken to switch over from the DPI to the new cars?
Travis, you got that?
I got that.
I was going to ask even more than that, Travis. Are you able to run anything from last year's car on this new car? Is it completely a new car?
It's pretty much completely a new car, you know, and we're still in the process of switching over right now. And I'm in Charlotte right now with meeting up with Mike's guys tomorrow. So trying to get the car ready to go and homologated, but nothing's really the same. You know, there's a few nuances that are carried over on some of the safety systems and stuff, but everything's new. All the electronics, you know, all the scrutineering systems. And like you mentioned earlier, previous years you were able to do things with the cars and everybody had their own little niche that they would do. You know, in the homologation process, like with Mike and I were running the same cars. They have to be identical. I mean, you're not even allowed to run different colored tape on the for firewalls for heat protection. So that's something new that we're trying to get through, and it's a difficult process because everybody has vendors that you're used to using. Everybody has processes you're doing, and now you're at the point where all your processes, all your builds, everything has to be identical across the teams if you're in that manufacturer. And I think, you know, that's the same thing a lot of the other manufacturers are dealing with, that have multi-car teams with, you know, cars in different locations. So it's definitely a process. And I think until we get through Daytona, I don't know that we're going to quite be where we need to be as far as all the parts availability, all the stuff that we're trying to get sorted, especially in this time frame with all the delays and stuff that are still happening in shipping. So it's quite a big task that we're taking on right now. Wouldn't you say, Mike?
Yeah, this is beyond anything I think any of us have been a part of before in a lot of different, you know, we've all seen a lot. And this car is so technically advanced compared to anything that's in North America right now. And, you know, it's not quite Formula One, but it's getting frightfully close to it now with the capability. The fans are going to love it. I think the fans are going to love seeing the cars, which is great. And I love that part of it, but it's a tough time for all the teams, no matter what manufacturer you are right now. The cars are so cool, though. I mean, we're leaving. I don't know if this will happen in the Rolex, but all of the cars are capable of leaving the pit box on full electric, and then they kind of bump start themselves to start going down the pit lane. It's just a whole new era, which is really good for the OEM. It's just the first year is going to be tough on all of us, you know. So,
The excitement is fantastic on it. I know it from the TV side. As you guys know, we've been trying to put together a deal, kind of a drive to survive from an IMSA pro side, and we're still thrilled, still working on that. But I think the excitement of everything, and if you bring in a lot of the hyper cars that, you know, knowing that sooner or later those cars will evolve, the Peugeot, the Ferrari, will evolve into one class. I have no doubt that eventually we're going to come to, it may be 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road, but at some point here, we're going to merge back into one single class again. When's the homologation final for you guys? Is that going to be like a post-Roar thing?
Tomorrow.
Travis or
yep, tomorrow is homologation. We're stripping the cars down tomorrow, and then when we show up at the December test, the cars are supposed to be homologated and ready to go racing. So hopefully by tomorrow night we have some final direction on things. But this is the second time we've kind of gone through this process, and I think the wind tunnel side's pretty much complete. So now it's just the parts and components. So that's what we'll be doing all day tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
Will anybody get a chance to test it before the Roar?
Our plan is to test 2 days in Daytona, first week in Daytona before the Roar, and try to get the cars on track as they're going to be homologated. So we're running basically by the rule book.
Wow.
Have you guys?
There should be other things there too, I would imagine. Wow.
I saw Porsche. I saw Porsche had been doing a 24-hour test or a 30-hour test at Sebring. Have you guys done anything together or separately to really try to put some hours on it?
We've done a lot of miles together, and both of us have been working on different things at different times to basically build up to that 24-hour run. Different tracks, different places. I know, Mike, you were at Daytona, I believe. So I think we've got a lot of miles on. It's just now we're at the point of getting everything ready to go for this homologation, and then determining, some of those final things that are going to come out tomorrow are really going to determine how we run on this next test and put the miles on there.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Porsche, when is their DPI car going to come out?
It's out.
Okay, it will be this year. I wasn't clear on that. That's why I asked.
Yep.
Has anybody seen it? Where's the
customer?
Where's
the
team
the
base?
The cars are not going to be.
It's customer. Okay.
So the customer cars have taken a big evolution. I remember when I started in '73, you could buy a competitive race car for $18,000 to $20,000. And expect to win races with it. And I think the new Porsche is what, 2.3 million?
Okay. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. I think when I saw when they first came out, it's like 2.3 million, and then they want to make sure you've got like 7 to 8 million in escrow that you can be able to run the thing, you know. So, I mean, that's a concern that I've got. Michael, knowing what the running budget has been compared to what the running budget's going to be, what do you guys, Travis or Michael, what do you figure your increase is going to be in a running budget over for this year? 25-30% from what it was last year?
Double.
Yeah. Well, you got to take into account two things, though, right? You got the car cost, and then you've got the inflation cost and everything going up right now. So we're taking two hits at the same time.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, my gosh.
Jeez.
Pile on the big cap.
What's that, Travis?
I said, and I think we're all in the same thing. I was going to say, I think Mike and I both months ago about it, and we did our numbers separately, and we were both within a couple percentage of each other. So I think everybody's on the same page.
Right.
Well, do you think there'll ever be a cost yet? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Drew.
No, I was just asking you if you think there would ever be a cost cap in the regulations.
I don't see that yet. I don't see that. Obviously, they did it in Formula One, and they're all very happy with the cost cap, even though it causes them some problems. But, already, LMDH or /GTP is way, way less than the old kind of P1 cars back from 08 to 2014 or 15. They're spending $100 million a year doing WEC. Now, they've got it way, way cut back now. So they've kind of done it themselves within the rules, I would say. I've never heard of any kind of cost cap coming our way. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I would think that's something you're going to have to let it ride there for a year or two and actually see what the, how durable the cars are going to be and the parts and all the rest of it. Speaking of durable, you guys had a suspension issue at one of the tests or something? Is that I'm sure that's been solved by now. Was that surprising?
All I'll say is that we've all had challenges in this stuff and had lots of different things happen. So we have them happen and we deal with it and we go on. So
yeah. Well, that's why you go testing.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Trish.
How do you think you're going to take it and race against the hypercars in WEC?
What was your question? It's kind of hard to hear you.
I'm sorry. Do you see taking these to Le Mans, racing against WEC, getting into FIA with these cars?
I think it's very possible. It's very possible we could. We're certainly going to be watching that landscape for the next year or so. And, we'll see how it goes. But everything is kind of wide open right now, and that's one of the cool things that they're doing. So I would say, yes, it's very possible, but I just don't know when for us.
Well, NASCAR is going to do it. You just get to watch it.
Right.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things, and the guys I know, and you guys have certainly been in that conversation, I think the hypercars are allowed to run all-wheel drive. And certainly in certain circumstances, an all-wheel drive car, could potentially have a lot of advantage, think a damp track and, in the rain and things like that. So I think that's one of the concerns and why the Ferrari is not going to be a Daytona or the Peugeot and some of these other cars. Because we want to make sure, and I say we, I think IMSA wants to make sure that the playing field is level for the full-time teams here and not just allow a guest appearance of a car that's outside of the framework that's been designed right now.
Gary, I can tell you that obviously all-wheel drive to two-wheel is a concern, but I can tell you that there's all kinds of things they're doing to equalize the car, to include the all-wheel drive can't kick in to like 150 or 70 kph. You can't have all-wheel drive coming out of corners. So they're looking at that and doing lots of simulation to try to see where that will end up. And time will tell, and they'll work on it, and that'll be that.
Yeah. Is IMSA involved in those tests as well, Michael, or is that strictly WEC?
I'm not sure who's heading that up. Travis may know. I don't know, but I don't know exactly. I think IMSA is definitely part of the conversation for sure. I don't know who's doing all the sims. So.
Yeah, I don't know who's doing all the sim, but I think IMSA is involved, and I think some of the places that IMSA has contracted to help them probably involved as well. You know, there is a lot of collaboration across IMSA and ACO right now, and a lot of other stuff as well. So, you know, even in this homologation process, there's representatives from both IMSA and ACO at these events.
Mm-hmm. No, it's fantastic. I mean, if you look at, and even if we go back to the old GTB days, I mean, we did not have that many manufacturers that were involved compared to the response that, I mean, to get Ferrari to come out of the woodwork and build a car and Peugeot come back in and forget the other one, it's not Pagini, but one of the Italian manufacturers has signed back up, and Acura and Porsche and everybody is fantastic. I mean, you think about even back in the, you know, the 5, 12, 9, 17 days, you had three or four manufacturers. That was it. You know, so I think the response has been fantastic, and really hope that it works out great for you guys and with OEM support and brings a ton of sponsors and notoriety to the teams and the series.
Excuse me. I need to do a station identification, if you'll excuse me for just a minute. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on a number of podcast platforms. If you missed any of our previous shows, they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify podcasts. Now reaching millions of fans. Download the app, listen on your phone, car radio, or computer. Thank you. Okay, did I interrupt a train of thought, or shall we? Somebody else got a subject they want to bring in?
I think the only thing I was going to say. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Travis.
I was just going to say, with the manufacturers get involved and the excitement behind this new car and the technology, like Michael was saying, is I think we're bringing in a new generation of people that are going to start following sports car. The interest in what we're doing with this, with a younger generation that probably wasn't as interested in motorsports, is now becoming involved more so because of the hybrid involvement.
Yeah, you hear that a lot from the friends that I have that are in an ACO, and they get that same thing. There is a younger, whatever generation it is, that actually is interested in how fast can we go on how little fuel, you know, and that's kind of the push that they have, and they have a goal, you know, every year, every 2 years, you know, they want to shave a little bit fuel out of it and push a little bit forward the mileage on it. I had a question for you guys on the I know from being around WC and Colucci and I worked down at the Miami Grand Prix for the F1 this year, and I know there was a whole training program around the F1 cars, you know, how to disconnect the electric, how not to touch the car, the lights that were on, don't get near it, and then you still occasionally see a driver gets out of the car in F1 and has to make that leap from the car, not wanting to be the ground. Is there any kind of that training going forward with these cars? Is there a concern? I know with the R18 Audi and the Peugeot, you know, if there was a crash on track, the first thing, one of the emergency cars would come by the pit and grab a technician to go out and deal with the car. Are these cars going to have that same kind of issue on track for the marshals, or is it going to be a little more fail-safe?
Do we take that, Mike, or you want that one?
You got it, Travis. You got it, buddy.
So I think IMSA's done a pretty good job on putting things together so that there's a chain of communication, using some, you know, Discord and everything that each team representative is on. each team has a designated person that is their safety officer that's listed on the entry as well. So if there's an issue with any callers, it comes across Discord so we all know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Also, with the safety team, they've been very, very proactive. I know they've been at MSR's pit and our pit multiple times going through the cars. There are the disconnects in place. They are the quarantine areas in place should you have an issue. I think going into it, every team goes through training. So it doesn't matter if it's marketing all the way up to engineers. There's different levels of training we go through. It's all color coordinated of, if you see that any of the safety stanchions out, then unless you're an amber or a red, you got to stay away from the car. So but a lot of that stuff is in place. But my personal opinion is the way this system is set up with the lights, the safety behind it, and everything that everybody's doing, it's probably as safe, if not safer, than your car on the street that's a hybrid.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah,
I know when I was at Red Atlanta, we had the Ferrari Corsa Cliente comes, and we had a lot of the FXXKs, fully electric car, and we had to go through, and for our staff at track, we had rubber mats, we had to have special gloves, special shoes, just if you had an incident where you had to go after the car, and that was 4 or 5 years ago. And I think the awareness and the ability to shut things off from the outside is much better than what it was then. But, I mean, it was spooky, thinking about
it. And we still have all that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's going to reach out and bite you.
And it definitely can. I think that the safety precautions that are in place, we still have all that stuff. There's color ports, there's color tools that are for live cars and, we've had conversations with IMSA about certain things where, pit lane was a question, right? Because not all GTP cars are going to be pitted together. You're going to have GTD cars and other cars next to you in pit lane. So it's not just the training for the teams running these cars. It's the training beside them. And that comes down to if there's an issue, a crew guy next door, their instant reaction is to go help that team next to them if there's an issue. But you got to understand with this car, you can't respond the way that you normally would with a regular race car. So those things, IMSA's put in place to help us take care of that. And then I think, a couple of the other things that are really good that they're doing is when you're in, the car goes around tech. And anytime you're in the paddock, the system has to be on so that the green light system is on. So you can't transport the car anywhere without the safety system on. So if the light's not green, you're pretty much stuck where it is, and it also can't mm-hmm. go anywhere without a safety officer with it. So there's a lot of things in place to protect the fans, protect other teams that aren't aware of the car, keep people from just walking up and touching the car. And there are driver precautions. The driver does know that if there is an issue, you don't touch the ground at the same time as the car. You jump out of the car. And that goes into the GTD side as well. There could be an issue where the two cars are touching. So all the drivers have to be aware of their surroundings. So IMSA's done a pretty good job on that.
Kaluj, what were some things that we had to worry about in the GTB days? tighten the tires and keep the bottom facing the track.
Don't get your electronics. The electronics were pretty much an imaginary thing. It was pretty simple.
How many guys do you have on your electronics, Mike?
How many on electronics? We've got between our group and HPD, there's 10 probably.
At our first test, we had 28 stations set up for engineering and electronics.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's a lot. That is a lot.
So, how does the telemetry change from last year to this year? Is there a big upgrade on that, or is it pretty much the
kind of the same thing, and then they just put a couple more columns in there. Is this car a lot smarter in what it sends out?
It does have more. Yeah, I mean, there's more capability from the data system and telemetry. We have to look at more, and you have more people analyzing data in real time also. So you have your ICE guys, your internal combustion guys, you have your hybrid guys, you have performance engineers trying to make it all work together, and then our group trying to work with their group to come up with answers and resolutions to issues or good things that are happening, actually. So, but there's a multitude of adjustments that you just never had before in modern race cars now, all because of the hybrid system. And so we're all adapting to it, you know, and figuring out what we need.
Are all these guys coming out of Japan, or are they out of England, or where are they coming from?
HPD, they come from all over the world. We literally have people from all over the world. You know, a lot of people come from Formula E, Formula One. It's a hodgepodge. It's a mix of everyone to make it work, you know?
Uh-huh. Very cool. That is so cool.
Do you have to have a different or improved fire suppression system?
Travis, do you know that question?
Yes. We have to have a fire system that's got to be FIA approved, and it has to be located and have a certain amount of fire extinguisher in it. And I can't remember exactly what's in it, but yes, it's all has to be approved.
Okay. But it's different from what you've used in the past on your other cars.
Yeah, everything is different, and these cars have what they call a dousing port. So, each manufacturer, you basically, what we're trying to get to is everybody's developed a dousing port, which is if you have a thermal event of some sort. So safety crews and stuff know how to use this stuff. It's just a different system.
I have to laugh to myself right now, Travis, because when you said a dousing port, and I remember there was a small prototype, I think it was a Group 6 car at Le Mans, and it had a Cosworth in it, and they had a starter issue. And before the race, the guy actually cut a hole, and they fabricate a little tube. And then when they had to turn the car off, one mechanic would pour water down this tube, and they would douse the starter to cool the starter down. It's probably something like that, but a little different, right?
But somebody thought that up on the fly. Okay, here's the question everybody's waiting to hear. Who would you like to tell everyone who your drivers will be at the Rolex?
No.
We've announced three of our drivers. We're going to announce our fourth this weekend. So for us, it's Tom Blomqvist, Simon Pagenaud, and Elio Castroneves. And we'll announce our fourth before the end of the week here.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And somebody else had a definitive no. Okay. I understand. I really do.
I had a question.
Okay.
Michael or Travis, on these cars, when the driver's driving it now, and I know that the hybrid system is, you know, we're not talking about 50% of the power is not coming from the hybrid system, but can they actually feel, I mean, is there a kick of acceleration that they know that it comes in, or is it just a smooth transition as far as the power from the hybrid?
It's pretty smooth, I would say, Gary. It's really they've really refined it, and it's a fairly smooth thing. You know, you will notice if you come to these races, you will notice what I talked about, the cars leaving on all electric. If we indeed do that, we don't actually know if we'll be allowed to. The hybrid system we all have is the same, and it's all capable of doing that. But, you know, beyond that, I think it's fairly seamless, actually.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, it's just the regulations on how they put it all in place and what we can use and how many kilowatts we're going to be allowed to. It's a different formula than any of us are used to.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah. But you're going to love it, aren't you? Nobody's going to love it?
I'll answer that question tomorrow night.
Anybody got any questions out there? Now, okay. How are we doing?
To wrap it up.
Might as well.
Yeah.
Did you have any questions from the audience, Dave?
Yeah, we had some, but actually these guys answered them all. So.
I think so, too. We covered an awful lot of territory.
Yeah.
I'm very happy with it.
I have one more question, Trish.
Okay.
So for Michael or Travis, so, and this is a thing I discussed with Rafoff at one point that I really wanted when they were at Atlanta to just pull the restrictors out of these things and just, you know, fill them up and turn it loose. And I think back to...
Yeah.
Kaluj, weren't you at Hockenheim when they took the Nissan? The Nissan, they pulled the restrictors out of it and put like full-blown racing fuel in it, so it had 1,100 horsepower. Were you with that, or was that Shapiro?
No, that was me. We were doing the inter-series race at Hockenheim with a first-generation Nissan GTP car, and we ran without a restrictor. I'm not sure how much horsepower it made, but the thing was pretty awesome to watch on the straightaway.
I remember the photograph of it. So, Travis or Michael, have they run this thing? Do we have an idea if you know, we pulled the restrictors out of it and turned it loose? You know, is it gonna do a 102 at Red Atlanta?
It would. Yeah, I mean, if it was unrestricted, it'd be wicked fast. Yeah,
that's what we want to hear.
That's it. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Oh, great! That's a wonderful spot to end this on. Yes, we're going to have a very, very interesting 2023, and I can't wait. I wish the roar was televised, for that matter. But it's not. Everybody will be there, and their cars will be ready, and I'm not worried about it. So you can, you know,
yeah,
get your time
cool.
off. It would be safe. Oh, thank you for these great stories. This has been a fun night. And thanks to our audience.
Thank
Everybody, thanks for listening. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them ever on racinghistoryproject.com and also on the Internet Archive. We're taking the holidays off, no show in December, but we'll be back in January with season three. Actually, season three starts next month. The story of the January 18th, 2023. The story of Riverside, that iconic racetrack on the edge of the California desert, gone since 1989. Until then, goodbye from Race Talk with Trish. And I hope you have a wonderful night and happy holidays. Thank you.